listener, and welcome to the University of Maryland Extension Presents the Garden Hose Podcast, where we talk about getting down and dirty in the garden. We're your hosts. I'm Emily.
I'm Michaela.
I'm Rachel.
In this episode, we're covering part two of our April information. Specifically, we're going to talk about gardening with children. We're also going to talk about calorie pears and your native plant and bug of the month will be included in this episode. If you're looking for your gardening tips of the month, they would have been in April Part 1, which you can find on our Facebook page, on our website, or on iTunes or the Stitcher Podcast app. Without further ado, here's your April 2020 Part 2 episode. So, I do not have any children, so all of my gardening activities I get to do on my own, but I know both of you guys have small kids, so have you guys been engaging in the garden with them at all during our stay-at-home time?
Oh, have I?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the perfect weather to be outside with kids, because they don't need hat, full snowsuit, mittens, the whole nine yards.
And I feel like when they play outside, the longer they play outside, the longer nap they're going to take. So that is automatically a win for me.
And I got to tell you, I find it kind of funny that we're talking about specifically gardening activities with kids, because I just go out in the yard to work and she sort of finds things to do. So it's not as if I have cultivated an activity. She just kind of like explores, which I think is great because that's what the outdoors is for, is exploring.
Yeah, exactly.
That's perfect.
And then I kind of like try to make it into a lesson, you know, like, hey, look at this worm. How do worms move? Or, you know, hey, did you know worms don't have eyes? Or so, you know, I kind of try to integrate that into what we're doing so that I can instill in him some love for nature and our environment.
And Emily, you'll be so happy. Most kids are kind of afraid of bugs, but I think because we handle them so much and I make Fletcher kind of look at them, she doesn't get freaked out by bugs at all. And so you'll be very happy to know that.
That does make me happy.
In fact, she found a stink bug in the house the other day, and she grabbed it and brought it to me and goes, spider. And we had to talk about why it was not a spider.
Yeah. That's awesome.
We do want to instill in her that there are some bugs that we don't want to grab with our hands, though.
It's true. Yes, exactly. But
she's going to love that until the first time she grabs something like a wasp and then she gets stung.
Well, unfortunately, we do get paper wasps in our house sometimes.
Oh, wow.
So, yes, this is very true. We want to talk about what bugs are good and what bugs we don't want to handle.
Did I tell you that I found a wheel bug on Henry's car seat?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I remember you telling us last year.
Yeah, it was like 4 inches long, and I was like, ooh, buddy, let's move this outside. And Oliver was like, oh, that's so cool. And I was like, yeah, see the wheel on its back? This is a wheel bug. You know, and he's like, wow.
So, Rachel, maybe you want to explain the benefits of gardening for people who haven't had experience gardening with children or maybe taking this period of quarantine and using it to be more of a gardener.
Well, I think that gardening with children is a great activity because it teaches your children that, you know, it's okay to try different fruits and vegetables that they've grown. And it gives them ownership, like, hey, buddy, you planted this tomato. Let's make sure that, you know, it grows and it's healthy and that we, you know, pick off this ripe tomato. This is how you tell it's ripe, or this is when you leave it on the vine. It also lets them explore different sights and sounds and smells. Like, you can have them taste fresh cilantro or basil out of your garden after it's washed, of course.
Ew! Don't grow cilantro. It's gross.
It is not. It's delicious.
I'm one of the handful of people that it tastes like soap, so I would argue that not. So, but this is a great opportunity to figure out whether or not your child enjoys cilantro or not. You might have a soap cilantro child or not, so.
And I'm sorry, I'm with Rachel on this one. I love a bunch of cilantro. The more, the better.
So delicious.
So everyone says it either tastes like soap or it's like the best flavor in the world, but people can't describe that flavor to me, at least. So like I tasted and it literally tastes like a soap bar in my mouth.
Oh, no.
I think it tastes a little spicy. I don't think
I taste
soap.
Yeah, so do I. I don't taste soap. Mm-mm.
And it's not even a taste thing. Like, if someone is washing it in the sink, it smells like soap to me, too. Like, I just, it hits me. It's all soap.
I would love cilantro soap.
I think gardening is also really great for kids because it teaches them patience. Like, there's no instant gratification with gardening. You do something, and then you have to wait for that seed to grow, and then you have to wait for that plant to grow, and then you have to wait for that fruit to develop.
I would argue that weeding has instant gratification.
Okay. Weeding does. But I mean, like, this process of growing food is very much a patience thing.
Exactly.
So maybe gardening is great because it can fulfill both requirements.
Yes.
You have to learn patience with regards to waiting for the payoff, but you also get some instant and constant gratification through the maintenance of your garden.
Yeah. And I think that it also teaches children about a life cycle and how things move through the ecosystem. You teach them what happens when you plant that seed and then you're harvesting and then you're, you know, taking that plant and putting it into the compost pile to become, you know, food for next year's garden.
What are some ways that people can get started, especially if they don't have a very large property or garden to work with?
I would say that if you are starting out with a garden with your child, you want to start small. Don't be afraid to just do a container plant, especially if you're limited on space. That's a really good way to just throw a couple of herbs in a tomato plant in a container and see how it goes for a season. If you're doing well that way, expand it, but don't go gangbusters and try to do the biggest garden known to man, because that is something that most gardeners do, and then we regret it later.
So, and I believe we've talked about this in past episodes, for container gardening, you specifically want to use potting soil and potting mix, not ground soil, not gardening soil. You want something that's light and fluffy and not as dense. And when we talk about containers, things like 5-gallon buckets are great for vegetables, but you can also just use something like milk jugs. So if your kids are like Rachel's and they go through a gallon of milk a day, a week, an hour.
We go through 2 gallons a week now.
Okay. You probably have a lot of them. And the nice thing about using milk jugs is they have that built-in handle. So kids can carry them around and move them around the garden pretty easily.
And you can make milk jugs into a mini greenhouse as well. So that's what I start a lot of my seeds in that need to like overwinter and go through some cold stratification. I don't cut the top or the handle part all the way off. I make it like a lip, you know, so it comes up and down, almost like a giant Pac-Man, if you want to think about it that way. And I put some potting soil in the bottom, put my seeds in, and then I take off the cap. And then that still lets rainwater in. And it's a little tiny mini greenhouse. It's a great, great thing to use for kids to start out with. Most containers you do need to water really frequently because they can dry out easily, especially with Maryland summers.
We've done terrariums that similar way, but using like the gallon soda bottles where you cut them and then you can like slide it over the top of the bottom of it.
Yeah, that's a great idea as well.
That's fun.
As a mother, I have to talk about safety just a little bit because there are different rules depending on their ages and their understanding of being outside. Number one, wear closed-toed shoes if you can help it. Have them wear tennis shoes or even like the foam rubber kind of shoes that can get dirty and you can just kind of rinse them off. Exactly.
And I know that this is really hard. I have a hard time not running around barefoot. But after you have a small child step on a yellow jacket, you're going to wish that they had been wearing closed-toed shoes.
Yeah.
If you're going to start gardening with your children, don't be afraid to get messy. Use old clothing. Let them go out and dig in the ground and explore. Like, the messier, the better. They're going to have fun. They're going to love it.
And we also talk about wearing gloves, although if their hands are particularly small, that might be hard to do, which is why having those sensory bins or having their own kind of soil container to play with might be a good idea, because then you don't have to worry about what's in the soil as much. Definitely no picking and eating things without permission, because if they think a berry is red and that is okay, there's a lot of red berries out in the environment that are very poisonous. So you just want to make sure that you have that understanding. And if they're really that small, that you're keeping an eye on them around those kinds of plants, and always washing your hands. I like to say gardening is good for COVID, because you're washing your hands all the time and you don't want to touch your face because you get your face dirty. So we talk about washing our hands a lot and our food before we eat it as well. Look, but don't touch insects without permission. And if you as parents don't know what it is, definitely don't let them touch it. But we can all have a healthy regard for insects without being afraid of them at the same time. So we don't want to teach kids to step on any insect just because you might be afraid of it.
If you find a bug and you're not sure what it is, you can post a picture to our Facebook page, or you can send us an email at gardenhosepodcast@gmail.com, and we will happily ID it for you.
Michaela, do you want to talk about mud pie kitchens?
I can. So a great thing about the garden is it's sensory in many ways, and one of those ways is touch. So one of the things you can do is make a mud pie kitchen, which is filling a tub with dirt and letting the kids water it, play in it, make their own little patties or cakes. It gives them a safe place to play without risking anything in your garden. Like, I know I have plenty of pots sitting around with seeds in them, but to Fletcher, to my daughter, they just look like containers of soil. And so she ends up dumping them out. And so if I give her her own garden to play with, she's much less likely to interfere with what I'm doing. And honestly, it's hard to get mad because you're just so excited that they're playing in the soil and that they're interested in what you're interested in. And so one of the other things you can do is do different theme gardens. So there's a lot of different options out there. Some people do what's called a pizza garden, where you're growing the components of making a pizza, which would be tomatoes, bell peppers, and basil. You can do a salsa garden, which is kind of along the same lines, except you're going to grow Emily's favorite, cilantro. And then maybe you're doing onions and tomatoes as well. And then, of course, another great thing to do or to maybe start with is herbs. This is definitely combining both sensory and smell at the same time. So you can do basil, thyme, cilantro, lavender. Some things that are perennial, some things are annual, so you're doing them every year. It kind of is a nice way to mix it up. Making a color garden or a rainbow garden is another thing that can be kind of exciting.
Those are my favorite.
Yeah, so you're choosing,
mine too.
You're choosing different plants that represent those different colors. And a great book to read with this activity is called Planting a Rainbow by Lois Ellert.
I love that book. It's one of my favorites.
Another thing you can do that's kind of along the same lines as a rainbow garden is choose different cultivated varieties, so different types of vegetable seeds that are a different color than they normally are. Like, ooh, maybe you're doing red lettuce instead of green lettuce.
Or something like that. Or purple potted pole beans.
That's right. So there are so many different varieties out there. So that's a really cool thing to do with kids too, like purple beans.
Yeah. I think anytime you have a vegetable in a weird color, you can always get kids to try it a little bit more. Like,
Last year I grew indigo cherry tomatoes, and they are like an amethyst purple. They're absolutely beautiful cherry tomatoes. And the plant is even purple too. So if you didn't know that, you would think it has a phosphorus problem. But they were a great addition to our garden last year. Nice prolific cherry tomato.
So speaking of books, Rachel, maybe you want to share some of your garden reading favorites for kids.
I think that it's really fun to pair great books with gardening, especially for children, because you can read them a story and then you can go out to the garden and you can talk about what you read. So one of my all-time favorite books is called Tops and Bottoms by Janet Stevens. It's about a lazy bear who sleeps through every planting season. So a convincing hare makes a deal. He and his family will work through the bear's land and split the crops half and half. He'll let Bear choose which half he wants, tops or bottoms. Bear chooses tops for the first planting season, so the hare plants, what do you think, root crops, leaving Bear with the useless tops. A furious bear insists that next time he'll take the bottoms, so the hare plants corn, leaving empty stalks. It's a really cool, cute book. And you can coordinate activities with this, like plant radishes and talk about the tops and the bottoms, or carrots and lettuce, and which one of these do we eat? And after you get done with your crop, you can make a salad. And it introduces kids to the different parts of a plant and which ones we eat. So my next favorite book is From Seed to Plant by Gail Gibbons. It goes through the process of pollination, seed formation, and germination. And that's a really kind of a technical book. It's more for grades like 3 to 5. But I'd like to pair it with The Bad Seed by Jory John.
Oh, I love that book.
I love The Bad Seed.
It's a good one. It's funny.
It is hilarious. It's about corn kernels, pistachios, peanuts, and other seeds. And when one seed goes bad, they talk about, you know, what makes him bad. And then he turns into a good seed. It's a hilarious little book. So activities that you could do for this, for pairing these two, is the seeds in a glove activity. It's a great activity. So you just take a clear plastic food glove, like a food grade glove, and you put a wet cotton ball at the bottom of each finger with a seed and just tape it to the window. And they learn about germination, which seeds germinate faster. And we can put the directions online as well. But one of my other favorite books, I have so many, I'm sorry guys, is Monsters Don't Eat My Broccoli by Barbara Jean Hicks. Monsters insist that they don't like broccoli. They'd rather snack on tractors or rocket ships or tender trailer tidbits or really wheelies or steely stews. But boy, do these trees that they're munching on look a awful lot like broccoli. So it's just about how monsters don't like their vegetable that they really do like. And it's kind of like saying, your child saying, hey, I don't like raisins, but then they'll eat cinnamon raisin bread. Yeah. An activity to do with this is make a snack. Sunflower seeds can be the seeds and make it a little tree. So we got some sunflower seeds at the bottom that are seeds, and carrot shreds can be the roots. Celery can be the stem. And any leafy vegetable can be the leaves, like lettuce or arugula or something like that. Broccoli can be the top of the tree or the plant, and then hummus for them to dip as a healthy alternative to ranch dressing.
That sounds really good.
It does sound delicious. I want to eat now.
Michaela, do you and Fletcher have a favorite gardening kids book?
I like The Bad Seed. That's probably my favorite. And I don't know if it's directly gardening related, but she had this book when she was a baby. It was called The Little Yellow Bee, and it's one of those flip flap books, so you look under the flap to see different insects and different things in the garden. And she loved that even up till when she's like 2 years old. So even though it's a baby's book, she really enjoys it.
So I have one that I always like to do when I am specifically teaching for pre-K and kindergarten, and it's called Up, Down, and Around, and it's by Catherine Aries. And this one's really nice because it talks about plants out in the garden that grow up, grow down, and then grow around things. So you can have, as you read it, you have kids stand up, and then you have cans sit down, and then you have them stand up and spin around. So it's like carrots grow down, and broccoli grows up, and beans grow around and around. So it's just this kind of fun book that you can make interactive. So I highly recommend that.
I really love as well Velma Granch and the Way Cool Butterfly. I really like to do this one for older kids. It's probably like ages 6 to 8 because it has a lot of text on it, but it's about monarch butterflies. So that's another one that's a really cool book as well.
It's also very cool to take the opportunity to point out any incorrect items in books, because, Emily, you'll appreciate this. I was reading a book to Fletcher about bugs, And it called a spider an insect. And we had to talk about how spiders are arachnids and they don't technically belong in the insect family.
Oh, yeah.
It engages adults, too.
Yes, they can. One thing that you can also do with particularly older kids, if picture books are a little, you know, if they're right at that cusp of picture books kind of being, you know, too childish for them, is you can engage them in really taking the STEM and science aspect of gardening into play. So things like asking them to keep a science journal for the garden. So like, when did we plant this? And let's measure how tall it gets every day. And let's count how many, you know, fruits and vegetables we get off of them. Let's weigh them. Let's try to engage in maybe kind of more of that STEM, science, technology, mathematic aspect of gardening. This can be kind of fun.
I agree. That's a lot of fun.
And then one last thing I like to include is you can always have your kids do scavenger hunts, because even younger kids, if you give them tasks for things to find on the property, they can handle that, as well as the older kids who also find it, it's a nice challenge. So, and you can do so many different variations with a scavenger hunt, but, you know, I say things like, can you find me a purple flower, or can you find a feather, or something to that degree?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. So there's one tree that blooms really early in the landscape, and while some people take this as a sign of spring, I'm here to tell you that those calorie pear trees are very detrimental to the landscape. These are the white blooming trees, and usually they're the very first thing to bloom in March, right next to red maple, but they are not native. So we get a lot of questions. What is a Bradford pear? What's a calorie pear? Are they the same thing? I'm here to tell you that calorie pear is actually a species of ornamental pear trees with many different cultivars or cultivated varieties, and these are sold by plant nurseries. So these cultivars are developed to exhibit certain desirable qualities, like large white blooms or a great fall color. So in the circumstance of Bradford, which is actually a cultivated variety of calorie pear, it was developed for those beautiful landscape properties and the fact that it was sterile. It was supposed to have produced fruits that were not viable, and on their own, they are not. However, while Bradford pears are very popular early on, it was discovered only later after the trees matured that the trees had very weak wood. They split and they lose branches very easily. It doesn't take much for those branches to break. So this led to the rise of other cultivars of calorie pear developed to have stronger wood or a more of upright form. However, with these other cultivars available, the once sterile Bradford pear varieties can cross-pollinate, and the pears became very invasive as a result. So they were able to have viable offspring because they could cross-pollinate with the other cultivated varieties and other ornamental pears. So these new offspring do not exhibit the same qualities that the varieties were bred for, and they often revert back to the very undesirable qualities like poor fall color, sharp thorns, and the fact that they have a poor growing habit. So there you have it. That's why we see so many invasive calorie pears in the landscape. Please avoid planting these trees at all costs. And by the way, nurseries in Maryland are still allowed to sell these trees, but have to be labeled as having invasive habits. So even though they're available, even though you might be enticed by the big white blooms, the attractive blossoms, please do not purchase these trees. There are so many other alternatives. So redbud is one that blooms a little bit later in the season, but it's just about ready now here in April, and it should be blossoming with these warmer temperatures. So redbud has almost a lavender color to it. It's a small tree. It also likes more of a shaded habitat, so it's a very good transition area tree, so it can go from where you have lawn or shrubs to trees and forest. Another one that likes that kind of habitat is flowering dogwood, and those have the big white blossoms. They aren't in clusters, but they do have quite an impact. They're very attractive. Red maple, like I mentioned before, is one of the earliest trees to blossom in the spring, and I believe it was my native plant pick of the month last month. Serviceberry is another one that blooms right on the heels of calorie pear, and they often get mistaken for them because they can grow in wooded or shaded areas, but they're actually a shrub. They're a smaller shrub or tree, and they produce edible fruits. And some of my other picks include white fringe tree, which is a native tree that blooms in the spring. It has a wonderful smell, very attractive.
Unlike calorie pear, that smells really gross.
That's right. It's one of the things I failed to mention about the calorie pear is they were able to breed all of these desirable qualities except for the smell. The smell of Bradford pear smells like rotting fruit. It's really unattractive. So that's why white fringe tree might be a nice alternative. And they're white blossoms. It's an attractive tree. It doesn't get very big. It's got strong wood, so it doesn't split like those calorie pears do. And then we have a couple of native crab apples as well as plums that might be desirable for homeowners who are looking for a flowering fruit tree.
It's the Native Plants of the Month with Michaela.
So the Native Plant of the Month was a difficult one to choose because there are so many native plants blooming in April. But believe it or not, it's not a grass this month.
What?
I refrained from grass. Grasses do not shine in the spring, you guys. It's really not their time. Don't worry. We'll wait until fall and then it'll all be native grasses. So one of my favorite, but maybe less commonly known one, is a native azalea named Pinkster Bloom Azalea or Rhododendron Periclymenoides. Do you like how that rolled off the tongue? Did it sound professional?
You have a way with Latin names. It's amazing.
Such a way with Latin names. So this is a deciduous azalea, and the leaves are barely coming out in the spring when large clusters of pink flowers are bursting out. They're actually quite fragrant, and they're very distinctive because the rest of the shrub is fairly leggy and bare, so it almost looks like they're these floating orbs of pink flowers.
How pretty.
Yeah, it's very pretty. I have included a photo that I hope we can post on the website or Facebook.
Yeah, I'll post some photos.
Okay. So like most azaleas, they love acidic soils that are rich in organic matter. You'll find them in their native habitat along edges of acidic forests, and they prefer more of a part shade habitat. While they can tolerate some dry and sandy soils, they prefer well-drained soils. So in those heavier clay, they will not do very well, and they'll experience root rot and very poor growth. So this is not a very tall shrub. It only reaches about 2 to 5 feet max, and it's best suited for more naturalized areas. They're very different than the commercial double-blooming azaleas that are very popular in the landscape industry. While those are like electric pink, this is a much more subtle color, and it's much more natural looking. I actually think it's more appealing just because it doesn't look out of place. It's a great option for shady and acidic gardens that have that layer of rich organic soil. And that might be perfect if you have rows of loblollies or particularly acidic hardwood forests as well. So most commercial azaleas are susceptible to insect and disease issues, including rot, powdery mildew, aphids, lace bugs, and a lot more. So the advantage to using the Pinkster Bloom Azalea, or our native azalea, is that they have a higher tolerance and better resistance to these problems. I won't say they're problem or, you know, issue free, but they do have a higher resistance and they're much more well adapted to this area and they can fight off those different issues.
Now, Michaela, how readily available will these be at native plant nurseries?
I would say...
Or is this more like the stink cabbage where I'm going to find it out in the wild, but I can't really put it in my garden?
So I misspoke. So you can actually get a hold of skunk cabbage now, but I did find it at a native plant nursery this spring. They released their plant list. The Pinkster Bloom, you'll probably be able to find at native plant-specific nurseries. Probably not the larger, more commercial landscape industries, but you definitely can find it at a native plant-specific nursery.
Okay, cool.
And Look, azaleas are one of those things that they look awesome when they're in bloom at the plant nursery. And so it really makes you want to buy them.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect example of if you don't have the right place for them, they really aren't going to survive very well. So you're better off finding a plant that's well suited for the area you're looking for, not the other way around.
Exactly.
And if you're ever in question as to whether you have the right plant for the right place, always talk to the staff at a native plant nursery because they're very knowledgeable and they'll be able to tell you right away whether this is well suited for your landscape.
What's buzzing? It's the bug of the month with Emily.
This month's bug of the month is the Eastern Tent Caterpillar. Common pest that you will find in early spring. Their preferred host is wild cherries, but they will also be found on things like crab apple or apple trees, as well as peach, plums, witch hazel, roses, birch, beech, willow, and poplar trees. So they overwinter as eggs, and one way to control them is to hunt for those egg masses and to remove them before they hatch. The egg masses are going to be about 1 inch long, and they're going to be kind of a black gulk that's normally going to be found like on a twig. And these are going to hatch normally in that first to second week in April, and then the caterpillars will make their way down to kind of a split in the branches, and then they will build a tent together. All of them will live in this tent, and the tent will get larger and larger as the caterpillars grow. At dusk, dawn, and evening, they will venture out of their tent to feed on the leaves of the tree and then come back into the tent during daytime. So the tent's really providing them not only protection from predators, but also protection from kind of the elements. You'll normally find the feeding damage done in May because that's when the caterpillars have gotten large enough and their feeding has actually gotten distinct enough that you'll start noticing it, as well as the tents are oftentimes larger than that. So they'll feed throughout May, and when they are ready to pupate, that's when you'll find them leaving the tent. And this is when you're likely going to find the caterpillars more so just kind of crawling around. They are black and brown, kind of fuzzy, but they have that very distinct white stripe down the back. They are pretty docile caterpillars, so they are a little bit more kid-friendly. If you have a young nature lover, they're a great one to kind of watch crawl around for a little bit. But again, you want to kind of put them back out into nature. They will find a place to pupate. The moths will emerge from their pupae in early summer. They're a plain brown-looking moth that will have these little tan stripes on it that sort of make a tent-like pattern on their wings. They will mate, lay eggs, and die. They have a very short lifespan as an actual moth. Those eggs will overwinter, and the cycle repeats. If you do have these in your trees, they don't really harm the tree very much, as long as you have a healthy tree. They are feeding early enough that a healthy tree can easily replace any of these eaten leaves, and in some cases will actually generate more leaves to compensate for those that have been eaten. Control is not necessary. You can look for and remove those egg masses in fall and winter or early spring. You can also take a stick or something and rip open that tent, and a lot of times other animals will come in and feed on them. We don't really recommend chemical control. If you do need chemical control, you're better off contacting a landscaping company than doing it yourself. A lot of people will oftentimes get them confused with forest tent caterpillars, which are also found early in the spring, but forest tent caterpillars prefer to feed on shade trees and flowering fruit trees, and they don't have the white line down their back, but instead have a series of white dots. And that's all I've got to say about Eastern tent caterpillars.
Well, that's it for this episode, listener. We hope you enjoyed it and that you learned a lot. We hope that you and your family stay safe during this difficult time.
If you have any garden-related questions, please email us at gardenhosepodcast@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook at The Garden Hose Podcast. For more information about the University of Maryland Extension and these topics, please check out the University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information Center website at extension.umd.edu/HGIC. Thanks for listening, and have fun getting down and dirty in your garden. Goodbye!
Garden Hose is brought to you by University of Maryland Extension. Michaela Boley, Senior Agent Associate for Talbot County for Horticulture, Rachel Rhodes, Agent Associate for Horticulture in Queen Anne's County, and Emily Zobel, Agriculture Agent in Dorchester County.